Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How do you feel?
I'm feeling uneasy, man.
Well, look, Bart, I don't want to suggest anything that might be uncomfortable for you, but you might consider, just consider the possibility that part of your problem, part of the thing that's making you so miserable is the angst over killing a lot of people.
I got invited to my 10-year high school reunion. What am I going to say? Killed the president of Paraguay with a fork. How have you been?
Get out of town. Visit with what's-her-name.
Debbie.
Go see some old friends. Have some punch. Don't kill anybody for a few days. See what it feels like.
I'll give it a shot.
Don't give it a shot. Don't shoot anything.
Hey there, and welcome to Rewatchability. We're on the Entertainment One Podcast Network. My name is Blaine Waters. With me, as always, is...
Robert LaRonde.
And...
Oh, wait. Hold on. I've got a thing. Okay. Say and again.
And is that your name?
That's are you a blister in the sun?
Are you a violent femme?
No, it's Jan McNabb.
All right.
I had my guitar coincidentally sitting here and I thought I should do something.
Yeah.
Nice.
When I played the drums in high school, it was my favorite song to play on the drums until it got into the song itself. But the intro was you just hit the snare drum twice, and that was really fun to play along with.
Right. Well, that's nothing. My kids could play that.
Hey, man. Wow. That took me 5 years of practice.
Poor Blaine.
Okay. Well, if you can't tell from that lovely introduction by JM, we're talking about Gross Point Blank. Before we get into the movie, we want to thank our Patreons. Thank you so much for going to patreon.com/rewatchability and giving $135 a month to us dudes doing this podcast. We really appreciate it, and it keeps the podcast going.
If it wasn't for that, we might have to, like, you know, start taking on odd jobs, if you know what I mean.
God. So if you don't know,
like,
what we
painting
mean,
fences.
With human blood.
I heard you do that.
So this week on Rewatchability, we have a pretty big movie for me. Anyway, we'll see what you guys think of it. Gross Point Blank, starring John Cusack, starring Joan Cusack. All the Cusacks are in this.
Do you say Cusack?
Yeah, I thought it was Cusack.
I thought it was Cusack, too.
Jacques. No, I'm saying it wrong, then.
No, I don't know. Maybe I have no idea what it is.
I'll take my Cusack from you guys and say Cusack. This has all the Cusack siblings in it. It also has Minnie Driver and a lot of writers. And George Armitage, who we've talked about before on the podcast, directed for the, what was it called? Miami Blues.
Miami Blues.
Oh, yeah, that's the basketball team.
How do I know the title? I wasn't on that episode.
You know about movies, though. See, that's the thing. We don't.
I really liked that movie when I was a kid, so I wished that I had been on that episode because I remember enjoying that one.
It was a good one.
So let's get into it. Rob, when did you first see Gross Point Blank?
Yeah, I saw this movie on the Movie Network. I'd already seen High Fidelity at the time, so I was a big fan of John Cusack, and I just thought he was really cool. At the time, I was in theater school. I wanted to be an actor, and he seemed like a really cool actor. Like, he did all this, like, cool, like, political theater stuff. He's in like the what's it called? The Cradle of Rock. I almost said The Hand That Rocks the Cradle. But he seemed like a really cool guy. So when I saw this movie, I thought it was like really cool. It had a lot of the same tone as High Fidelity. There was like lots of, I guess, lots of music that I liked and recognized. So yeah, I liked it. I don't know if I had seen it since the first time. You know, it doesn't. There's something about it that doesn't really stick with me. Like I remember the humor. I guess I remember Dan Aykroyd because he seems so weird in that part. But
yeah.
I mean, I was excited to see it again because I only had I think positive memories of it. What about you, Jam?
I love this movie. I was a big fan of it. I saw it opening day in the theater.
Wow.
After school, like a matinee. And I, it's so funny. It made such an impression on me that like watching it again now, like there are still jokes where I remember where the big laughs were.
Like in the theater.
That first time I saw it. Yeah. And I liked it so much that I saw it on that Friday that it came out. And then 2 days later, me and the same friend I had seen it with were planning on going to see a movie. And we were looking at like the movie listings and we were both just like, fuck, I think I just want to go see Gross Point Blank again. So we went and saw it again 2 days later. We were that invested. And I remember it being like a huge movie in our age group. Like we were, it's weird because I was thinking about it now. It's like, what did I latch onto so much about it being like a 12 or 13 year old
school nostalgia.
Even been to high school. Yeah. It was like nostalgia for a thing I had not even experienced yet, which is kind of weird. But I mean, we'll talk about that more later. But I remember everybody kind of buzzing about it. I remember like me and my friend going to see it and other people in our grade on Monday being like, oh my God, you saw Gross Point Blank. Like, what was it like? And you know, recounting the events of the legend of Martin Blank. And I became mildly obsessed with this movie. I also, like, a big thing for me, like I'm sure for a lot of fans of this movie, was the music and the soundtrack.
So good.
And I had the soundtrack on cassette.
Whoa.
And I wore that thing thin listening to it. And I even had, like, they put out, you know, if it's a good soundtrack if they have, like, two volumes. Because they put out, like, the second volume with music that didn't quite make the cut in the first one.
Grosser Point Blank.
Yeah. So I had both of them. I listened to them constantly. And it was also kind of a revelation because I think for, like, kids at the time who, you know, didn't know a lot about music or maybe just starting to get into music in the 90s, like, the kind of like, you know, grunge rock consensus for kids at the time was that like 80s music was bad, right?
Right. Sure.
Rob, you remember that.
I remember the grunge symposium. Kurt Cobain spoke on the terrors of 80s music.
But just like that's what, like, you know, starting to listen to the radio as like a kid, you know, watching Much Music here in Canada and music videos, like there was a sense that like this is good music in the 80s was like a wasteland of like synthy garbage. Yeah. And getting into this was like, you know, it's funny because this movie is so about like looking back at this music and looking back at these bands. But this was like the first time I'd heard The Clash and Echo and the Bunnymen and all of these bands that I came to love. But it was almost, yeah, it almost acted as like a surrogate older brother, you know, kind of like introducing these bands to me. So, yeah, this was a huge movie for me. I've seen it a couple times since I've been older, but it's been a while. What about you, Blaine? You said this was a big one for
you too. Yeah, I just absolutely loved it. I got the poster from the video store when it was like, I asked the guy when it was going to come down and like how much it was going to be. Like, I planned for it. Like, I wanted it.
Wow.
I put it above my drum set.
You were like,
so you could play that one part.
So I could just hit it twice in succession. I remember the poster so vividly because of that and the movie itself so vividly. I bought the tape when I could afford it. It was just like such a, I just loved that it was like an action romance. It kind of is the movie that might have really got me into rom-coms at an early age.
Oh.
Because this was kind of...
Not When Harry Met Sally.
Well, I think When Harry Met Sally was more formative for me later. I'm not taking it as a joke. No, When Harry Met Sally is a big deal for me. But no, this kind of felt like it was a rom-com geared for dudes. Like, it was like, we're going to have all the gunfights and we're going to have this guy who...
See also the entire career of John Cusack.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. And like the big hit, which we've done on this podcast really early, that I think came after this movie and was like, hey, we're the grocer point blank, like you said, Rob. But wasn't. And I just love this movie so much.
Can we just say, while you're talking about the poster, yeah, just before I forget, I think this might be the best example of like a huge discrepancy between the quality of the movie and the shittiness of a poster. This is a terrible poster.
Well, it's just like, yeah, John Cusack and Minnie Driver facing each other, right? Like, there's nothing much to it.
They're like standing there. They're like boxed in by like yellow bars. And then there's this like
pink background,
amateurishly photoshopped like banner of like class of 86, like waving behind them. And
yeah. Is there even a gun in the poster? Like, is he holding a gun?
I think in one of the posters, he's like making like a finger gun.
It's just like, that doesn't tell you anything this movie is about. So yeah, the poster
has fingers in it.
It does. There's a lot of finger pointing. But yeah, I quite love this movie. I also really remember it being really strange when I first watched it, like really caustic and weird, and then thinking that that must have been a mismemory of it. But watching it again, realizing that that's just the kind of like crazy energy between these two actors on screen, John Cusack and Minnie Driver, which we'll get into. So Rob, why don't you run down the movie for those who haven't seen Gross Point Blank?
Okay. So John Cusack plays Martin Q. Blank, and he is a hitman, a gun for hire, if you will, an assassin. And he it's his profession. It's not a hobby. You know, he does this to bring home the bacon. And so when we see him, he's sort of in the middle of a job, and he sort of does all this while he's talking on the phone to his assistant, played by his sister, Joan Cusack.
It's a package deal every time.
It's a package deal. It's usually two for one, but you're right. There are like 18 Cusacks in this movie.
Yeah.
So
it's a family
and
reunion.
They're all amazing. They're all great.
Yeah, yeah. First family of acting. But he is a hitman, and, you know, he's taking out this guy, and he shoots the guy and does the thing. And it's sort of like, he barely even stops his conversation with his assistant in order to take a person's life. But, you know, that's just the game. That's just what it's like when you're a hitman.
But they were all bad, Rob. They're bad dudes. Someone sent him to kill them, and therefore they're bad. That's his kind of like philosophy in this movie.
Well, he is in this opening scene, like they do have it specifically be him killing another hitman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Like he's preventing an assassination. So like they do find early ways to try and make this professional killer kind of like
yeah.
And
because they also have like in a moment in like the next scene, like, you know, the like screenwriting, like save the cat moment, like make this guy likable, is him refusing to blow up a Greenpeace
plant. Yeah. Even though they deserve it, right? No,
stupid environment.
Who needs it? Yeah, but somebody comes along after he kills this person who's going to kill the other person and kills the person that he killed was supposed to kill. So that's not great.
This is how the screenwriter pitched it in the meeting, right?
This guy kills this guy.
Yeah, exactly.
And he's murdered by Dan Aykroyd, Canada's own beloved Ghostbuster. And, I mean, it's a bit startling when you see middle-aged Dan Aykroyd gunned down a couple of people.
It's a visual metaphor for the Ghostbusters franchise.
Do you think that the Ghostbusters have like some sort of deal? Like he makes more ghosts and then they bust them?
Oh man, there's your sequel idea. Just like a really dark turn where there's no ghosts left in New York City, so Ray has to go around murdering criminals.
Just making sure they have unfinished business before. Like, hey, have you achieved your dreams? No, great.
Just as soon as someone drops off dry cleaning, murder them.
And he's doing other hits as well. Like there's this one that he tries to do where he's in this the ceiling above this guy who's sleeping, and he has this syringe and like this liquid, presumably poison, is running down this thread and it's going to drip into his mouth. That's pretty fucking cool. Mm-hmm. But also makes me not want to sleep.
Right? Well, you should check your ceiling every time you go to bed, Rob.
Well, I'm staring right up at it.
I took a lot of things away from this movie, and not one of them was don't go to sleep. But, you know, to each his own.
Well, and so, I mean, his head doesn't seem to be quite in the game anyway, but his assistant has gotten this letter for him all about his upcoming 10th year high school reunion, and she really thinks that he should go. And he's not really interested. He doesn't want to go back and be nostalgic and reminisce. He's, you know, he's left all that behind him. But because he messed up the job, the guys who were paying him want him to do like a freebie in Detroit, which just happens to be right by where he went to high school, where the reunion is happening. So he might as well just go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, he does.
Well, he's also encouraged to go by his therapist, played by Alan Arkin.
Oh, yeah, Alan Arkin's, I mean, amazing
so
in everything.
He's but, so great. You
know, he's not his therapist. He is, I mean, he is basically holding Alan Arkin hostage.
I love the little banter of like the I'm emotionally involved. Like I think you're gonna kill me. That's why I'm emotionally involved. Like I love his fear throughout the entire scene.
Martin, you didn't tell me what you did for a living.
Yes, I did.
You didn't tell me what you did for a living for four sessions. Then you told me, and I said I don't want to work with you. And yet you come back every week at the same time. That's a difficulty for me. On top of that, if you've committed a crime or if you're thinking about committing a crime, I have to tell the authorities.
I know the law, okay? But I don't want to be withholding. I'm very serious about this process. And I know where you live.
Oh, now see, that wasn't a nice thing to say. That wasn't designed to make me feel good.
It's so amazing. Good. But I also, I don't know that I buy Alan Arkin being afraid of John Cusack. John Cusack being afraid of Alan Arkin, yes, 100%. But Alan Arkin's like, too much of a tough, like, shit, you know? Like, I don't, you know, he doesn't seem terrified to me.
I do like that he has that kind of, like, you know, when, like, one dog meets another dog and, like, lowers its head or whatever as a show of contrition? Like, mm-hmm. Alan Arkin does that in the entire scene. He's, like, looking down at his desk, moving things on his desk. Like, I don't know. How do you want me to respond to you? I don't know. Like, don't kill me. I just love everything.
Well, one thing I didn't really remember from seeing it when I was younger is that everyone in these opening scenes that John Cusack interacts with is immediately relieved when he leaves the room.
Yeah.
Like even his assistant, played by Joan Cusack, like as soon as he leaves, she just goes, oh, and like this tension goes. And the same thing happens with Alan Arkin. So like even though, he's not like the most obviously threatening person, like there is something about this John Cusack character, this kind of sociopathic killer that like puts people ill at ease, you know, that makes them, they feel better when he's not in the room. And that's the thing with Alan Arkin. It's not just that he's like afraid of him, it's that he doesn't want him to come there. And he's told him repeatedly not to come.
Yeah. It's pretty funny.
Yeah,
but so he gets packed and he goes back to Michigan, to Grosse Pointe, I guess. And it's the town that he comes from. He hasn't been back in years. And he is obsessed, as Alan Arkin says, with this person named Debbie. I mean, he has like these dreams about her, and we don't know who Debbie is at this point. Is it just an ice cream or a cake or something? Like Little Debbie?
Little Debbie.
But he has some unfinished business. We're about to find out sort of what the nature of that is. So he drives through town. He basically, the first thing that he sees as he gets in the town is he turns his head and he sees the radio station, which conveniently they just happened to be, they had the broadcast booth right through the window so you can see it on the main street. But it just happens that Debbie, his long-lost love is working at the radio station. So this is very convenient because he can just hop out of the car and go see her, which he does.
At this point, we kind of meet these other two people that are following him, right? Hank Azaria and co.
Yeah, that's right. He's being pursued by other people. And they also, Dan Aykroyd's character, he also wants to get Martin into this sort of like union of hitmen. He wants to basically create like the John Wick hotel thing.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, we got to get this before these other guys, before fucking Ian McShane fixes up his place, because once he gets in there, you know, we're not, you know, it's not going to happen.
Well, also, we should mention that the two guys following him are NSA agents. Mm-hmm. And it's Hank Azaria and K. Todd Freeman is the other actor.
Yeah. And so they want to kill him, but only while he's doing something illegal. That's the catch. That's apparently, I mean, this seems different from real life where, you know, the authorities can only kill you if you're doing something wrong. In real life, of course, they can kill you whenever, especially if you're like not a white person. But in this movie, no.
I mean, it's true. It's true. But it raises those kind of ethical questions really early in the script, which I kind of liked, where everyone's kind of a killer. Like, even the supposed good guys that are going after Martin Blank are like, this is why we're the good guys. Like, we're still psychopaths. We still want to kill him, but we have to follow this code, which in a way makes them a little worse than him, because he's like, I'm thinking of giving it up. It's just a great little maneuver that the screenwriter does here that I really like.
I didn't really remember that. Like, they do kind of like, I remember it being more about like how, I mean, obviously it's trying to make the argument that him being an assassin is a bad thing, but it does make you buy into his argument that like the moral conduct that we adhere to is, you know, somewhat relative, and there are gray areas. And especially in that scene where like the two NSA agents are talking and they're saying like, or one of them says, why can't we just go and kill the guy he's supposed to kill? And they're like, the other guy's like, whoa, we're not criminals. We're going to watch while he kills that guy. We're going to let it happen, and then we're going to kill him.
And that's why we're the good guys.
And they're like, and then we're the good guys. Yeah, so like the movie does kind of like make this argument that like John Cusack is not a villain.
Yeah.
You know, he's doing things that are as bad as like two federal agents who are, you know, working within the confines of the law.
Yeah. And I mean, especially later in the movie, John Cusack makes the point, drives it home that like, yeah, governments and other agencies do worse things all the time, like carpet bombing, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff about the Iraq war in this movie. The first one I'm talking about. Talking about the first Iraq war, not the
Jesus Christ.
Not the second one. Don't get too confused. No.
Oh, yeah.
There's no sequel to this, but there was a sequel to that. So
well, there was a pseudo sequel. Which we'll probably talk
about. That's true. But so Martin, he goes and sees Debbie at the radio station, and she puts him right on the air and is calling him out on his bullshit. I mean, particularly the bullshit that 10 years ago at their prom, he stood her up and just fucking disappeared. And didn't come back until this point in the movie, until the reunion. He just ghosted her. And we know that's not cool.
Yeah. Leave a note.
Leave a note. That's what I always say. Always leave a note. But, she has him on the radio. And she even takes, like, calls, you know, asking whether or not she should give him another chance.
A girl sits in a $700 prom dress on the front steps of her house, waiting for the most romantic night of her young life. The boy never shows up. Not until now. So, what's the question?
Where have I been?
More like what happened, Mr. Blank.
I don't know. I mean, I could venture a guess, but I think it would sound like a rationalization, you know, some sort of a cop-out. I thought coming home, seeing some friends, and I thought maybe, you know, seeing you, of course, would be the most important part of that equation. That didn't come out right. This is not like my idea. This whole thing is my therapist's idea, really.
And, you know, this is pretty funny. This, you know, he's not happy to be on the radio. And, yeah, it's fun stuff.
Yeah, it's a good re-meet cute in terms of, like, the rom-comness of it all. Especially with that, like, first kiss where they just are so attracted to each other and kiss. And then she totally digs into him and breaks down why he was so mean to her in the past. And I just love that whole sequence, too.
Yeah, yeah. I read on the interweb that kiss was improvised by Minnie Driver.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Yeah, I love that part. And, she immediately, like, I love that they immediately address the issue of how he left and, you know, the damage that he wrought. Like, it's not something that comes out later. It comes out immediately. Mm-hmm. Like, it's so, and it just builds from there, you know? It's not like anything's wasted.
Yeah, exactly. And nothing is kind of, like you said, left for later to build towards. They're like, no, we'll just get it all out. And that, in fact, is Minnie Driver's character.
Yeah.
She's so... I just want to say how great Minnie Driver is in this movie. I just...
Oh, yeah, so
she's
good.
For me, she's the star of this movie, and she's the best part of it. So, anyway.
I was thinking about this movie and her, and, like, as much as I love this movie and as much as I love the performances, I feel like every other role in this movie I could see another actor in, except for Minnie Driver.
Yes.
I literally can't separate that character from the actress.
That's very well said.
I don't see it working with someone else.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, there are apparently three versions of this movie. One that was, like, true to the script. One that was a little more embellished. And then one that was off-the-wall rockers, improvised. Everyone went big. And Armitage said he used 80% of those takes in this movie. So there's a much more subdued version of this film out there. But I think using Minnie Driver to her limit was the absolute right thing to do. Like,
and it's, yeah, he uses, from what I understand, he used a lot of improv in this movie. He let the actors improv a lot. And I think that shows in, like, all the weird dialogue that happens. Like, there's just weird things that people say. Yeah. And I remember when I saw it as a kid, just, like, kind of thinking, like, I like this and it's cool, but, like, I probably don't get a lot of the references. And watching it now, it's like, no, it's not a reference. It's just, like, weird shit people are saying. And it's kind of made, like, why is Dan Aykroyd always
saying
popcorn?
That's what I was going to say, popcorn.
I don't know. But it's cool. It's funny. It works.
It's so weird. And, like, when she's, like, leaning against the wall and is like, you're a psycho, and she says it with her hand, like, it's just so playful and almost, like, I don't know, when I went to theater school, that's how people behaved. Like, you know, all the actors were just, like, showing off for each other. And that's what it felt like on screen, except it really...
Less cringy.
Way less cringy. And it really supported the characters. Like, I felt like these characters would actually do that. And, like, her running back to her bed and being, like, do an airplane. Like, fly. Like, it was... All that stuff was just so weird and delightful and made this movie so much better than the movie it could have been.
Yeah, they all feel like they have a history, and every character feels like they're quirky and they're having, like, little short scenes with John Cusack, but they all feel so real. We feel like we're just getting glimpses of these people, and then they're leaving and having their own story. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, they feel like they have their own thing going on. Even Minnie Driver, to an extent, like, she's just got these weird details. Like, she just went through a divorce, and then, like, at one point, when we see that she's living at home, she's like, oh, yeah, my apartment burned down. It's like, your apartment burned down? Like,
that's
so
a whole
many...
other movie right there. Yeah.
And we don't have time to, like, go into it, but you just, like, get the sense that there are all these other stories happening in the background, and it just, like, fills in the background in such a realistic way. Like, even, like, when we get to the reunion scene, not to jump ahead too much, there's just a character in a wedding dress and they never address it. No one talks about it. No one explains it. It's just like, yeah, there's probably something weird happening there. We don't have time to stop.
She's probably a species
and deal with that.
Remember the species wore a wedding dress for a while?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, things aren't all the same in Grosse Pointe as when Martin Blank left it 10 years ago. Like, for example, he goes back home and he finds that his house is not there, but rather it is a convenience store, which is inconvenient for him.
Q Just yeah. saying it, knowing that you hate your own joke. I love it. I love the delivery.
I love
that.
My joke.
Oh man! And yeah, but this is also a great sequence. This is great. The destruction of the mart, of the convenience store.
Well, I was gonna say he goes to visit his mom first, and
oh god,
and she's sad.
This is the scene of the movie that I didn't remember because I think I
blocked it out.
Yeah, like forced myself not to remember.
That
it.
Doesn't happen to our parents, does it?
Oh god. Yeah, it was so sad and like something I went through with like my grandmother. So it was just really interesting to like see on screen and be like,
your grandmother was a professional hitman?
she would have been, man. She would have been. But yeah, no, it was just an interesting scene to see, and it really showed you a lot about his character too. The fact that he didn't feel a need to come home and almost maybe ran away from home for that reason, or could never come back for this same reason.
Well, I still remember when this movie came out. I remember reading a review in the paper. I don't remember which paper it was, but I still remember reading them talk about the scene that comes right after that, where he goes to the grave, the cemetery, and visits his dad's grave, and just like there's no dialogue, he just takes out a bottle of booze, pours it out in its entirety, tosses the bottle and walks away. And I remember the review saying like that one wordless scene like tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, about his upbringing,
about his background. Yeah. Yeah,
that's how to deal with your man feelings.
No, it's good. I just thought it was just so, it was informative, but not like, you know, it didn't explain it. It tells you how to feel about it with like emotion and mm-hmm. like gestures.
Yeah.
And
well, that's the whole thing.
And, yeah. Yeah. Like without, you know.
Yeah. The whole screenwriters.
It's never brought up again. Yeah.
Tenet of like show, don't tell, you know, like you always want to show, not tell. And this does it exactly perfectly. Easily.
Which ironically is not what they did in Tenet.
They said a lot of things that I couldn't hear in that movie. That was good.
But so eventually John Cusack sort of convinces Minnie Driver to go to the reunion with him as his date, sort of. And so they go and do that. But first, she thinks that he's going to stand her up again, and he almost does, but then he doesn't, and then they go, and that's the thing. And they go to the reunion, and it's lots of fun. You see lots of familiar faces from the past. They see Jenna Elfman. She went to that school. The guy who plays Abraham on The Walking Dead, he was there.
Okay, sweet.
It was Jeremy Piven in The Walking Dead. Who are you talking about?
Well, the guy with the mustache, Bob, who he gets into a fight with.
Oh, that's right. Oh, yeah, crazy. I was still watching The Walking Dead when he was.
Yeah, cool. That's right.
And I just want to say about Jenna Elfman, because it's funny because her character is talking about like all of this crazy like mysticism and stuff because she had a near-death experience, I didn't think was funny at the time, but now it's funny because she's a Scientologist, isn't she?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, she's great. She's great.
It's just
this is her like her feature debut, so she
is
kills
it?
It. Yeah.
Doesn't she also have that great monologue or whatever in
Can't Hardly Wait? Yeah.
She's great at cameos. Just, you know, you just give her 30 seconds. That's all she needs.
And isn't the dad like Minnie Driver's dad from Dharma and Greg?
I don't know.
He was one of the dads in that.
Yeah, he was one of the dads in that. You're right.
He was either the dad to Dharma or to Greg.
Mm.
I don't remember which.
One of those.
Yeah. Yeah, and you did mention Jeremy Piven, who is in this movie, because he was just in all the John Cusack rom-com movies you get a 2-for-1 deal with the Cusacks, and then if you order right now, we'll throw in Jeremy Piven.
Well, you know why? Because
this is just a support group for the Cusacks and Jeremy Piven.
But Jeremy Piven was part of John Cusack's production company that did this movie. And the writing credits, the other 3 or 17 writers on it are the people in John Cusack's production company that took this.
Well,
yeah.
I read on IMDb that Jeremy Piven and John Cusack are like childhood friends.
They were high school friends, yeah. Yeah, as well. The plot thickens, yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't he like Me Too, though?
Well, Piven? Yeah. Piven has had 3 accusations against him, and so no longer gets TV roles, but is doing stand-up across the country.
Wait.
Which everyone wants to see that stand-up. And he said that he is, quote-unquote, collateral damage of the Me Too movement, that people are thinking he's more Ari Gold than he is himself.
No, the real collateral damage are the audiences at those comedy clubs.
He apparently talks about it in his stand-up set, too, where he's like, I don't know who they think I was. I would never do that. There's no apology in his apology on his tweets. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure there's also no apology on what I'm guessing is called the No Apology Tour.
You know what I hate about political correctness? That's the joke.
That's the joke. So he, at this reunion, this guy's been following me a long time. They destroyed the convenience store in this shootout, and he kills him with a pen in the high school, and Minnie Driver sees it.
Yeah.
Well, it's also the pen that he was just given by, like, one of his old classmates.
Yeah, I like that.
That's so great.
Yeah.
And then he also says, thanks
to the pen, Bob, like, at the end.
Yeah. Great. I love it. And it's so, like, subtle. Like, they don't really, like, draw too much attention to the line.
Yeah.
He's just like, thank you for the pen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's, what's his name?
It's Benny the Jet Urquidez.
Yeah, yeah.
But he was, like, his mentor, his, like, kickboxing mentor.
Yeah, right. Yeah, from Say Anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he
that's when they met.
That's when they met. And he still kickboxes today.
This John movie Cusack. Is just all John Cusack's friends and family.
Dude, like, if you could make a movie, wouldn't you? Like, wouldn't you just invite everyone that you like hanging out with? Like,
well,
sounds great.
Some of you don't have screen presence. I'm sorry.
I hope I'm not misremembering this, but I did listen to him on WTF a while ago, and I remember him talking about this movie and getting Benny the Jet to be in it. And I think, if I'm remembering right, I think it was the kind of situation where, kind of like with Conan, where they were talking about like, oh, we got to get someone and then like train them how to kickbox. And then at a certain point, they're like, well, instead of getting like Benny to like train some actor, why don't we just get him to come?
Yeah.
I think
that's really cool. John,
look. He has the best look. Like, I just love this like squat guy in a suit walking down the street. He's so conspicuous. It's amazing.
And I the scene where he comes to the reunion and just looks at all the cards that are still left. And he's like, it is I, Paul, you know, whatever the name is. I thought he was so funny. And the way he like kind of like salutes the woman at the desk as he walks away. It's so perfect. Yeah. But I also in that interview, John Cusack was talking about when they were filming the scene. And he said like by the end of it, he was just like exhausted and like drenched in sweat and just like bruised. And he said, you know, Benny the Jet didn't look like he'd, you know.
Yeah.
Even like cracked a sweat. Is that the expression? Broken a sweat.
He broke all the sweats.
Yeah. John Cusack broke all the sweat. Benny the Jet did not.
That's cool. Yeah, it's good that he gets the chance to be like in front of the screen. He worked on so many movies behind the screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and then he kind of, you know, gets Jeremy Piven to... If anyone's going to help you bury a body, I assume it would be Jeremy Piven.
you might as well call him because his hands aren't clean.
I don't know what happened between those episodes of Entourage, but I don't know if that joke works. I've never seen Entourage.
Didn't he get mercury poisoning from David Mamet's play or something? I don't know.
What?
Was it him who got mercury poisoning and he had to like drop out of a play or something?
Oh my God.
From eating too much sushi?
Was he eating too many Buffalo Head Nichols?
So they get rid of the body, but yes, Minnie Driver sees him kill somebody, and then she realizes that all this joking about being a professional killer wasn't jokes. And so I mean that's a problem because I mean it sucks let me tell you, when you like somebody, you like, you know, maybe you start to have some feelings, or maybe there's some feelings reunited, and then you find out something about them, like, you know, they voted for Trump, or they're a professional killer, or...
Ooh.
Those are the big two.
One's worse. One's worse.
I can forgive the killing. It'd be like, they were all bad people, though, right? It's like, well, what does bad mean? It's like, okay, just shut up.
Also, I do the whole disposing of the body scene, I think, is also pretty great, mm-hmm. where Jeremy Piven comes and helps him because they have to, like, tear down the, like, believe and you can achieve banners to, like, wrap the corpse up.
Yeah,
in.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
But so then, I mean, he finally looks at, like, who he's supposed to be there to kill, because he's been so wrapped up in all of this, like, you know, the past and Debbie and going to this high school reunion, and, you know, that he didn't even bother to look at the folder. And wouldn't you know it, it's Debbie's dad. So, you know, no shotgun jokes, old man, when I pick up your daughter, huh? Because I'm packing too.
And this is what I do love this about this rom-com. That it, like, so many rom-coms have that, like, false fight where they're just like, we can't be together because you like red jelly beans and I also like red jelly beans and we need to split the jelly beans.
Two different.
And this is like...
You've been reading my jelly bean script, haven't you?
Look, it's coming along. It's just a draft or two away. But this, it just has such an irreconcilable difference. So when they do kind of like butt heads in the hotel room where he's staying, she's like, no, I never want to see you again. Like, you aren't going to change my mind.
Yeah, and he's got like a gun in one hand. He looks crazed, yeah. And she's freaking out. Yeah, you're right. It's the most like realistic version of that, like... third act split. Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally.
And then he has to go save the dad, which is which, you know, might put him back in the good books, hopefully, if he can pull it off.
Yeah.
And the dad, I don't know if I ever really noticed this before or thought much of it, but I guess the reason why the dad is being hunted is because he's like a whistleblower for a car company that had leaky sunroofs.
Is that?
Yeah,
what?
He says
really?
Something about that. Yeah. But I didn't know whether it was like a joke or he didn't understand or.
Because.
No, because they say, they call him a whistleblower at the beginning. They're like, you got to kill some whistleblower before a deposition or something.
Oh.
And then at the end, when John Cusack's saving him, he's like, all this for leaky sunroofs?
I mean, it's no joke. Four people drowned in a sedan.
Oh, shit.
Where's the handle? Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was for something else, because John Cusack does say, like, still defending oil companies and mob bosses and stuff. Like, I felt like it was a bigger thing. But if it's just leaky sunroofs, then
right, yeah.
That's also kind of a funny thing that he's done all these, he's defended all these horrible people, but then turned state's evidence on this leaky sunroof thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, because he does have that line where he says he's been like exploiting the people.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's a joke about that.
Yeah, yeah. But he shoots a bunch of holes in a bunch of people and puts Dan Aykroyd back on TV, and that's so much.
And you're not talking about a Soul Man revival.
Oh, God. I forgot about that.
So what was the paranormal show he did in Canada? Sci-Factor?
Sci-Factor.
Sci-Factor
was so bad.
It was just like, we need to fill the slot of X-Files. Go.
You can tell that, like, some of this movie is improv, because when we first meet Dan Aykroyd's character, he starts talking about, like, psycho energy, psychic energy and telekinesis.
Totally, totally. He's like, I made love to a ghost. They're like, we have to cut that out. We really have to cut that out.
Martin, what you need is a refreshing sip of new Crystal Head vodka. No, man.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
But he does. He kind of kills them all, and the father gives his blessing.
Yeah.
Marriage.
Well, I mean, he basically does the whole reconciliation speech while this shootout is happening. It's pretty it's pretty amazing, because he's just like, you know, he'll be like, and, you know, what I came to realize is that, hold on, bang, 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 that I love you.
Yeah. It's pretty great.
I was always afraid to
commit to a relationship.
What?
But now I'm ready to make it happen. We need to go upstairs now. It's not easy for me. I always control my emotions, my feelings, you know, and I just need time to change. Go in there. Lock the door. I mean, I wasn't exactly raised in a loving environment. It's not an excuse. It's a reason. You know, my soul is empty. It's up to me to fill it.
It's great, yeah, because this is the first time where he's telling the honest version of what happened.
Yeah.
When he left. And it's not like it's even that different from what we know happened. It's just he's kind of like explaining a little bit of his thought process. And again, like watching it now, like thinking a bit more of it, like the thing I hadn't really thought too much about is like the thing that he says, the reason why he left was specifically because he loved Minnie Driver and he had these like murderous impulses. He thought he should be far away from her. Mm. So that like kind of like nudges it out of the realm of selfishness and you know, makes it a little more relatable.
I'm just saying,
I can't be with you because I need to kill people.
Just write it down.
Well, also, I mean, he does say like, you know, that he had this like terrible home life and like it's not like a rationalization, but it's an explanation that he, you know, he filled that with something.
It would have been funny if in the script he was like, you should have seen me in my father's grave pouring out a bottle of whiskey. That tells you everything you need to know. It's like, damn it.
No, but I also think like there is, I mean, we get, you know, bits of this throughout the movie, but like there is something, you know, there's something different watching it now where I'm older than all of these characters. I don't know if I've watched it since being older than John Cusack. And I do feel like a certain sympathy towards him, more of a sympathy in terms of like the story of him being like a young impressionable kid who joins the military and gets kind of like scooped up and exploited by like, you know, government black ops missions and forced to like go in because he had this like, you know, moral flexibility. He was the one that was recruited for these, you know, these off the books, secret missions. And then, you know, he eventually went into business for himself. But like, I do feel more of like a protectiveness about like, you know, retroactively thinking about like an impressionable young kid being kind of caught up in this, especially like, I mean, the movie is so good because they call out specifically like the things that are happening and make jokes about them. So it doesn't feel like trite, but like when we first meet Dan Aykroyd, he says like, tells him like, I'm not looking for a father figure, but that's totally what it is. Like he filled this like vacuum of family with this like military family and these goons that he ended up working with. I don't know. I just feel like I feel so much more sympathy for him now. I feel so much more like his decision. It's less about his decision making than it is about him being kind of like exploited by the American government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's like a great point. You know, even if like not every kid turns out to be a professional killer, you know, it's still, you know, there's still a lot of exploitation and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the other thing about this ending where he's like finally he's being so honest in terms of like talking about where he's come from and where he's been and why he did what he did, but there's also like a certain honesty to him just like blatantly killing all of these people very skillfully, like because a part of it's like he knows that he's good at it and he's just kind of like being totally himself in front of everybody for the first time.
Yeah His kind of two truths are reconciled together in a final moment.
Yeah
And then this movie just kind of ends. I don't remember it being that fast of an ending, but it's like there's a shot in the car, Minnie Driver does a voiceover, and we're out to like...
They're gone.
It was so quick. There was no like... We had to rewind it. Me and my wife were watching it because we're like, wait, why does... How does she forgive him or like, you know, get on side with him? And it's just like...
He has a gun.
No, I love that because like he says like, will you marry me? And she just like shuts the door in his face. And then we later see them like riding together. And I don't know if you read this, Blaine, in your research, but I was reading one interview where he was saying, like, where George Armitage was saying that they had other scenes of, like, them, like, talking it through reconciling, and they all just felt kind of flabby, and it kind of made the ending drag. Yeah. And he said, like, they were in a screening room, and I think it was one of the executives just said, hey, why don't we just cut from that to them driving away? And they tried it, and it totally worked. Mm. And you just figure, like, yeah, everything indicates that they like each other and want to be with each other, and they have found a way to work through this. And his thing that she had a problem with, like, saved her dad's life.
And he's no longer doing it. He can give it up for her, right?
Yeah, so, he'll never go back.
And a certain part of it is the honesty, too, right? Like, it's not just the thing that he did. It's you know, the betrayal of him not being totally truthful.
Yeah. Yeah, I also think that the characters are just so well drawn by these actors and their improv and the script that we can understand what they'd say to each other. Like, we can almost play that scene in our mind that we don't need it. You're right. It is just a little abrupt because we don't have voiceover any other time in the movie. It's just her. But I guess it's her on recording in the studio, right? So it's not quite a voiceover. It's like her on the radio.
Yeah, exactly.
Saying that she's forgiving, forgetting. She's done with it. She doesn't need it. She's just getting out of town. It's a good one. So we're going to take a small little break. Then we're going to come back, Fast and Furious, for some trivia after these messages.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there and welcome back to Rewatchability. We are talking about Gross Point Blank. I had some trivia for you guys, but we've already talked about a lot of it. So we're going to play a different game.
What?
This evening. we're gonna play a different game, and it's going to be called, I'm making it up right now, Who Said That? Question mark. So these are tweets. These are tweets from people that we've talked about in this movie so far, the stars of the movie. And you get to try to match the tweet to the star, okay?
What?
Yeah. Yeah. So let's go with number one.
Okay, Jimmy.
Yeah.
You don't have Dan Aykroyd to do a carpool karaoke or something?
Okay, so let's go with thrilled to be victorious in this case. Thank you to everyone involved. Moving forward to the next chapter. It's a case someone was involved in, and they won. Who might that have been?
Huh.
Jeremy.
Oh, no.
He will not win that case.
Did Minnie Driver have a thing recently? Like a lawsuit?
Who knows?
Was it Jenna Elfman on behalf of the Church of Scientology?
They won another landmark case and more land. No.
Take that, Leah Remini, whatever your name is.
Is it Remini?
Yeah.
Yes, Leah Remini.
That's good. Okay, it's Dan Aykroyd after he someone made a tequila in a crystal skull. from a part of the world in which that actual myth was part of their culture.
Mm.
So he won that case against them.
Look, God. The aliens gave Dan Aykroyd the patent to crystal skull vodka.
For my next witness, I'd like to call the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. Mr. Lincoln? President Lincoln.
Rolls out the trap.
And to be fair, he put vodka in a skull first, you know?
Wait, so he won that case?
Yeah, he won it because he has a trademark of giving vodka
on the human skull?
Yeah.
A crystal
we
skull.
We owe him
okay?
money now.
Yeah, he should have sued Indiana Jones for that movie not to come out. He would have been everyone's hero It would have been.
Well, he was friends with Indiana Jones. He was in. He was in part two. Yeah. So.
Oh yeah.
Maybe he. Maybe he let him use it.
Okay, so the 5G will be proven to be very, very bad for people's health. I got source in the scientific community.
I'm wondering if these are all going to be.
You might just be right.
My alien pal Vlaxnor told me 5G will de-align your crystals.
But then, you know, now I'm thinking that John Cusack was in that Stephen King movie Cell, which was about how evil cell phones are.
I think it's Jenna Elfman. That sounds like some like woo that maybe right. Jenna Elfman.
I'm going to say Dan Aykroyd.
She's going to get
Dan
a lot
Aykroyd.
Of shade. She's getting a lot of shade from you guys. It was actually John Cusack.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that was actually John Cusack. But he did. He also tweeted out something that was
bring on the 6G,
rabidly anti-Semitic. It was just this thing that was like follow the money, and he didn't really realize that it was. He thought it was about the government and not about the Jewish people. So he was like, "I apologize. I retweeted that before I really looked at it. That's my fault. I'll learn my lesson." So.
I thought Follow the Money was from All the President's Men.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why. I don't know. But okay, so how can so many people in America love so much that is awful?
That's Piven.
He's just talking
He's
about his
fans. Own career, yeah. He's like, they love Entourage. Have you seen that? It's morally reprehensible.
I'm going to say the lady who played the teacher who doesn't have Ethan Frome on the curriculum. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I like that. People in America. That's a clue. The only non-American in this, Minnie Driver said that. And then,
you forgot Dan Aykroyd's Canadian.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did really forget that. And then let's go with my favorite one, Pans. Am I right? Question mark.
Mm.
Pans?
Pans. P-A-N-S.
Pans.
Am I right?
Oh, pans.
Pans.
You are right.
Pans.
Am I right? Question mark.
You're pans, right. Am I right?
Yeah.
Someone who got like really bad reviews of something?
It's a lone tweet. No
what
explanation.
What kind of pan are we talking about?
No explanation.
Okay. Alan Arkin? Is he on
oh,
Twitter?
Oh, yeah.
And you guessed it right. It was Alan Arkin.
Oh! Yeah.
He just tweeted all this random stuff. Like, his first few tweets were like, hi. And it was just hi. And then it was like, delete tweet, omit hi. The next three tweets were like him making jokes on the fact that he couldn't use Twitter. It was, I just
love
this.
Cool. I love seeing legendary actors on Twitter. Do you guys remember when Bob Balaban joined Twitter? He followed us. And he was like, oh, your podcast sounds really interesting, like revisiting old movies. I'll check it out. And I was like, I thought that was really cool. But also, I was like, I don't think Bob Balaban's going to like our podcast.
No.
Which is too bad because we love Bob Balaban.
I love Bob Balaban. I think it's not going to be his cup of tea.
Yeah, no. Fair enough.
Just a guess.
Fair enough.
He loves tea.
Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe he's listening to this.
I've been a long time listener. I've been listening for near a decade.
Okay, so that's the end of the best trivia rounds ever been played on Rewatchability.
Wow.
Thank you so much, guys.
Wow.
You should
get Trebek's old job.
I mean, I'm pretty good at it.
What is not?
I okay. That was a big critique. I'll take it as such. So Tom Jankiewicz wrote this movie. He was invited to his 10-year high school reunion, and he was trying to be a screenwriter while he worked in retail and was a teacher, because that's how much people care about paying teachers. And
did it ever work out for him?
And it did. The screenplay, Rob. So he went. He got the invitation. He went. This would make a good film. His brother said that he just went to the. What can I can only assume is a typewriter back then. I don't know. It was 2000. Not 2000. It was 1991 when he finished this and shopped it around.
He got a clay tablet.
He chiseled some stone. And
it does seem funny to me that he's a screenwriter with the last name Jankiewicz, because it just seems like he's the off-brand Mankiewicz.
Right. Yeah.
Jank. when is David Fincher's movie about the screenwriter of Gross Point Blank coming out?
Oh man. So he, you know, this movie was a big hit. I mean, not a huge hit, but critics liked it, the audiences liked it. It made $28 million on $15 million budget, and he then became a kind of script doctor, helping other people with their scripts in Hollywood.
Oh.
And he had a spec script that was being shopped around, and they got bought by Mandalay Pictures in 2000. And it was called Kung Fu Theater, and it was about a person who gets kind of sucked into a kung fu movie and has to live in that movie or find a way back.
A little bit Last Action Hero.
A little Last Action Hero, but with kung fu film. I'm there for it. I want to see that. I like that concept. So he died, that never got made, and then he eventually was invited to do a talk back at his alma mater about this movie. So they showed the movie, and in the middle of the Q&A, he collapsed, and he was pronounced dead at the hospital 40 minutes later. I know.
Yeah, that's
so
awful.
In front of all these students, it's a sad story. At 49, he was a very young man to have a heart attack.
The only worst thing at a Q&A is when somebody says, "This is more of a comment."
Jesus Christ.
Honestly, if he died before that, he got off easy.
God.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to make light of his passing.
That's really sad.
Because that is sad. But I am with Rob. No Q&A ever goes well. I've never been to a Q&A and thought that went well.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
He just died to get out of it.
Jeez.
No. Yeah, that's really sad. I mean,
it is.
Yeah, that's awful.
What a great, like, legacy to leave, you know, with, like, you know, only having, like, one screenplay and it being, like, one of these movies that is, like, you know, really unique and really great and, you know, lots of people remember it very fondly. So that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, I know it was, like, heavily rewritten by Cusack and his friends and the director and all these people. But, you know, that central concept of, like, you know, the hitman going back for his high school reunion is just a great idea. And also, like, you know, he wrote this in 91, you said? That's, like, so ahead of the curve in terms of, like, the, like, mid-90s, like, Tarantino, like, hitman movie renaissance that was about to happen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And Tarantino really was a big fan of George Armitage to such an extent that he apparently wanted to be an extra in this film, though that never materialized.
Well, there's the scene where the you can see the Pulp Fiction standee in the convenience store, and it gets shot up.
Yeah.
And I love that scene because I think at the time I just thought it was funny, but watching it now, it kind of puts the whole movie in a different light in a way, because it's also like, well, this is a world where Pulp Fiction exists, so it also kind of explains the John Cusack being like the slick assassin with the suits and the sunglasses and everything. Like, to a certain extent, you can see how he's also trying to emulate those kind of movie guys at the time. It's not just a movie. It's not just another hitman movie. It's a movie about a hitman in a world where hitman movies are also a thing. I mean, that's also, like, you know, that's partly why, like, every time he says he's a hitman, everyone just reacts. They think it's funny. I'm surprised no one was like, Pulp Fiction just came out. I just rented it at the Ultramart.
That movie made a lot of people go into hitmanning. Made it look really, you know, romantic and all that.
They need to choose a better name for hitmanning, you know? It's just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
None of them.
Someone
will
come up with something.
Assassin? Yeah. Come on. It has two asses in it.
Okay.
Gun for hire? Kind of phallic, right?
So let's wrap up here and go around and say if we think it's rewatchable. I think I know our answer. Rob, do you want to start us off?
You know, actually, I was really looking forward to rewatching this one, but it left me a little bit cold, to be honest.
Oh, fuck
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
Wow.
You guys brought up a lot of good points, but I don't know, like, I find it sort of lacking in a few sense. Like, there isn't really any, there's not a lot of, like, tension or, like, motivation. I mean, like, Cusack's motivation is kind of just to go out with Minnie Driver and do this thing, but, like, there isn't...
No, his motivation is, like, finding a new life, like, doing something. He's at this crossroads.
Well, that's, like... I mean, that's his internal thing.
He's like, do I
thing.
Re-engage with humanity?
But that's not, like, what he's, like, he doesn't have, like, a main, like, purpose, like, that he's externally, like, working towards. He's just sort of, like, in this town for this reunion, and whatever happens, happens, and, you know, hopefully he doesn't get killed. But, I mean, it could use something that's a little bit more, like, integral to, like, his being in order to sort of, I don't know, make it more engaged. And, you know, I like all the stuff with Minnie Driver, but I also, I kind of do wish that there was, like, a real... like a real conclusion to that. Like, okay, so he saves her dad's life, and I guess that makes it okay that he's probably killed, like, hundreds of people. Like, think about this. He probably has, like, hundreds of people who want to kill him. You just can't stop being a hitman and be like, okay, guys, I'm out. You know, he's going to have to be on the run for the rest of his life. So, you know, and yeah, he's probably going to go back. Come on. Nobody quits forever. It's like smoking or, you know, you go back. So I don't know.
Oh, yeah. You know, that reminds me, we didn't talk about the sort of pseudo sequel, the spiritual sequel
right.
to this
oh.
movie that was War Inc.
Right.
Did you guys watch that?
I think I did, but I don't remember enjoying it.
It's so forgettable
yeah,
to me.
It was bad.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a pseudo sequel because
like,
Joan
yeah,
Cusack
he's...
is his assistant again, and Dan Aykroyd is a bit player in it,
and he's a hitman.
Yeah, Dan Aykroyd's a different character. It's more of like
yeah,
a Creatures,
say.
Fish Called Wanda kind of thing. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna say it's mildly rewatchable. There's still a lot of fun stuff that happens, and like it's a very cool '90s movie. Like it sort of synthesizes a lot of the great things about like. You know, 90s movies, like the sort of rom-com aspects, the cool, hip Tarantino aspects, and it does do it in a sort of fun way. I don't know. I thought it would be something more, but that's just me. Okay, now you guys can say what you guys can just blow my opinion out of the water.
Well, I'm not going to blow your opinion out of the water. I think that you know, you have your opinion, man.
No,
it's just wrong. And no, it's not wrong. It's I just really love this movie, and I loved it so much before. And watching it this time, I watched it with my wife, and I'm more of a script guy. I love those little lines. I love the little bits of improv that like kind of come out of the script, the way it's constructed. And I look at that, and she looks at. You know, the relationships between characters in the movie and that kind of je ne sais quoi of two stars in this rom-com. And I agree with her. These two people were electric. Like, they were just very on the same level, like, and almost like egging each other on in these scenes in such a unique, wonderful way that made it so that when I was a kid, I was like, this is a little bit caustic and it's a bit weird. But now as an adult, I realized it just felt like everyone was so comfortable with each other and everyone was having so much fun. So I had so much fun watching it. Some of the hitman stuff, I was just like, I don't need to, like, it's kind of the opposite of when I was a kid and I watched it and loved the hitman stuff. And it was like, oh, that's cool. He kills him with a pen and he like flips the lid off and it's an insert shot. And that's fun. This was more like the airplane scene, you know, fly me on an airplane, we'll see if I can let you take me to the reunion and stuff. All that stuff was just so great and so lovely to watch, and made it really rewatchable.
Did you make
for
your
me.
Wife give you an airplane?
I just want to fly. So yeah, so I think it's just there's a lot of rewatchability factor in it. Just even the little lines, like JM, you were talking about her house burning down, but it burned down on Devil's Night or something, which is the night before
yeah.
Halloween in Chicago, where there's a lot of arson that happens. So there's just like all these little things that connect to other little things that you can kind of go down rabbit holes on. I just really thought it was a refreshing movie, and in its time period could have done a lot of things that other movies did in its time period that it didn't do. And I really liked that. I also really loved the guy who played, I think his name was Bob with the mustache. I thought he did Abraham from The Walking Dead. Yeah. I thought he did a great job in that interaction between
yeah,
those
good.
Two men was
he has soulful eyes.
It's really cool. Yeah. Yeah.
For a while.
So I'm gonna say this is highly rewatchable. I will rewatch it again, and it's kind of, I think it's gonna be one of those movies where people are like, what was a nice surprise in rewatchability of something that was rewatchable. I think I'll probably mention this. So, JM, what's your verdict?
I not only think this is rewatchable, I think this might be a perfect movie for
me. Wow.
I loved it as a kid. I love it as much now. I just think it's so terrific. I mean, part of it is I can't help but escape like the nostalgia of it. Like watching it now makes me think of seeing it then. But it's just I appreciate it on a whole other level now. I don't know. There's something just like alive about these characters and the way they're done. Even like there's when they go to the reunion, like the way we see the non-John Cusack characters interact with each other, you get the sense of how, like, well, he's been gone, but they've all been living in this town for the most part together since then. So, like, they all still have these, like, weird connections. Like, we even hear, like, Jeremy Piven, like, bought his BMW from Bob, the drunk guy we meet later. And, you know, it just feels very, like, lived in and very real. And, you know, I was thinking about the soundtrack a lot because, like I said, like that was a big thing for me. Like I watched the movie a bunch, but I listened to the soundtrack even more. And I'm not like a big movie soundtrack guy, but, you know, for the reasons I said, this one was particularly influential for me. But yeah, like I was doing some reading about it because, you know, there's not a lot of writing on the internet about this movie, but there were a few articles about the soundtrack. Mm-hmm. And there was a good one on the AV Club kind of breaking it down and kind of pointing out like how the movie uses the soundtrack to fairly subtly like mirror what's going on with the characters. Because it's such a terrific soundtrack. Like you would think they just pick the songs purely for the mood, but they're reflecting the scenes in ways like I hadn't even really noticed. Maybe it's super obvious, but like
when they play Rudy Can't Fail, they mean like Martin Can't Fail.
Right. And the Sean Astin comes. the opening scene, you know, Martin's at this crossroads where he is thinking like he's going to see life in a new way. And the first song is I Can See Clearly Now. And the first shot of the movie is literally him rinsing out his eye, Rob.
Right.
And they play I Can See Clearly right. Now. Because the rain is gone. And it's, you know, him kind of coming out of this fog of the last 10 years. But, I mean, there's lots of other examples of things like that. The fight scene against the other assassin is mirror in the bathroom is kind of his mirror image. There's other, you know, sort of parts where like lines
live and let die. He lives and he lets die.
Well, live and let die. That's about he's living, but he's letting like his childhood die because that's the song that comes when he sees that his house has been replaced by a convenience store.
And then they're playing the music version in the convenience store. That's funny.
Yeah. Because that's another thing I like about it is like the music is always, or almost always, apart from, we didn't talk about how the score is by Joe Strummer.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of Clash music
in it as
well. Is
the score in this movie?
Well, it's hard to tell because some of it sounds like songs, but it is in there.
Okay.
It's just kind of like, he does some like, kind of like synthy jams are pretty cool, but there are some other like jangly guitar bits that just sound like, you know, fragments of songs that he wrote, I guess.
I just thought maybe it was cheaper to get him as the composer and maybe get a couple of Clash songs in there for free than just pay for the Clash songs individually. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if he gave them a rate. But, and also, like, yeah, so I just think that the songs, yeah, they're, like, built into the fabric of the movie, not just because they're, like, going to a dance, but, like, Minnie Driver being this DJ, and also the songs being, like, this nostalgia thing for the characters, and, like, even, like, the AV Club article was pointing out, like, it doesn't really make sense.
No.
Like, like, the music is almost implausibly good for who these characters would be. Like, she was saying, like, you know, at this high school reunion, like they'd probably be playing like Peter Gabriel and
yeah.
shit, you know, like they wouldn't be playing all these like
old,
you know, deep cut
sounds and all
yeah
that.
So I mean, it's so good. And even like, you know, the blister and the sun thing we were talking about, like he it kind of is like a low-key you know, character beat. It shows you how his character has transformed in like a subtle way, because as he's coming into town, Blister in the Sun is blaring on the speakers for like 10 seconds and he turns it off. Mm-hmm. He turns it to the Clash. And then the end of the movie, he's leaving town, but he's letting Blister in the Sun play out. I also remember, because, yeah, like I had not heard the Violent Femmes. I remember being super into that song because of the soundtrack, as were my friends, and then having like one friend at school that was into them, and him being like, you know, you guys know that song's about masturbation. And we're like, no, we just saw it in a movie about like a hitman and thought it was cool. And like, no, like, look at the lyrics. And it is about
jerking. Aren't all songs about jerking off, though?
Kind of.
Isn't all artistic expression just jerking up? Go on, Jim.
But I do think the soundtrack, I just wanted to kind of highlight that because I think it is like so central to the movie's success, and not least of which because it's, you know, it's the bones on which like a lot of the story kind of rests on top mm-hmm. of. And man, I just think this movie's terrific. I'm kind of bummed that George Armitage didn't do that much. Like, he's like a Corman guy. Like, he...
Yeah. He did like
blaxploitation movies. And then after this movie, he made The Big Bounce, like the shitty Elmore right. Leonard movie with Owen Wilson. And then he never made anything else. And it's too bad. Because yeah, this movie's awesome. I will defend this movie for the rest of my life. I think it's special, in my opinion.
All right. So rewatchable. Mildly, right? Just like mildly rewatchable.
You can round up. You can say it's rewatchable.
We're gonna say this movie gets the rewatchability stamp of approval. We have a stamp, right? Thank you so.
No, we're still waiting for the stamps.
Okay. Thank you so much for listening this week. We're gonna come back to you next week with another movie from the past, a blast from the past, maybe Blast from the Past with Brendan Fraser. Who knows? We probably won't do that one.
He was trending on Twitter the other day, so we probably should have done it then.
Oh, yeah. Great idea.
Well, we'll go to the past and do it. And you can find all our back catalog at rewatchability.com. You can find us on any podcast player. You're listening to us on one right now, so you don't need to be told that. But you can contact us at Facebook, Instagram. You can go to patreon.com and kick us a few bucks. You can tell a friend about the podcast, because that's even more better than cash for us. Tell everyone
at your high school reunion.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what I forgot to ask. Sorry, I know like we're ending the show and no one is even listening anymore. They've turned it off to listen to a different podcast.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Did you guys have high school?
I was going to ask this too.
That
that's one thing I forgot.
I was going to ask this. No.
You just didn't want to feel left out. So you didn't go to your high school reunion, Rob?
I don't think that we had one. I mean, I remember when I was in high school, they were preparing for like a 50-year reunion for the high school. So maybe they were just trying to like, you know, get all the assassins in at the same place and time. But I don't know. I mean, I never got any letter. Maybe I was invited. I don't know. I mean... I don't know.
Yeah, my high school was turned into
a convenience store.
No, it's being demolished and turned into like a residence at Queens, I think, mm-hmm. in Kingston. I don't really know what other people are more involved in that than I am. But I never got anything.
It's probably being torn down by Dan Aykroyd.
I never got an invitation either. Although I did go back many years later and film a short film at my old high school. And that was a trip. That was a really weird. What about you, JM? Did you?
Yeah, we never had one either. Yeah. It's just not a thing people do anymore.
I thought it was more of an American thing. I mean, maybe also just because I mostly know it from episodes of American TV, like the one where the Simpsons go to the high school reunion or the one.
Yeah.
I remember like when it would have been my 10-year high school reunion, I had probably because of Gross Point Blank. Like I thought it would be a thing that I'd be invited to. And then I realized it wasn't happening. And I thought, oh, that's too bad. I thought this was like a touchstone, like a cultural touchstone that I've seen in movies. And then I thought, do I have to be the one to organize it? And then I immediately thought, I'm not going to do that because then I'd be like that woman at the desk who was so annoying.
So uncool,
so I'm not,
man.
I'm not going to
so
do that.
So uncool.
Yeah.
People who do things
I'd be. I'm the Martin Blank. Like, you invite me and then have me like pretend like I'm too cool to go. That's
yeah.
That's my job here.
Yeah. I mean, maybe they're all saving up for the 25-year anniversary, like to get us back there, because that's like a more substantial 10 years doesn't even feel like anything.
No. Yeah, know? That's the thing, like 10 years doesn't seem like enough to reunite. Also, I guess the other thing is that we all have Facebook, so if there are any people that you want to know what they're doing from high school, you can just do that.
That's true. That is true. Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, I did want to say one last thing about the music in this movie. In the reunion scene, that scene where John Cusack's holding the baby and
so
Under
good.
Pressure is playing is so good. That's one of my favorite scenes in any movie.
Also, that baby acting? Come on.
What do you mean you don't know? You don't like that part?
I think that's like a little bit much. You know, I mean, great song, great baby, but it's kind of like... Yeah, I mean, that's the moment where he like learns to feel. It's like, I could never feel empathy until I looked into a child's eyes while Under Pressure by David Bowie and Queen playing. I don't know. It just seems like
Why would he even have been like in the same room as a baby? All his friends are.
Well, he probably like killed
like
some people who had children.
Oh, that's true.
He's just like looking at the baby in the eye before he takes out his gun.
I will also say, before this podcast, I went for like a walk. And I put on the Gross Point Blank soundtrack, and I was listening to it, and it made me feel great. And I was listening to Under Pressure, and I was like, man, why don't I just listen to the song every day? Every time I go for one of these, you know, pandemic quarantine walks, I'm listening to like fucking Tom Waits or some sad music as I skulk around. But put on Under Pressure. It cheered me right up.
I did all right. That day.
Well, that's it from us at Rewatchability. Thank you so much for listening, and go pick up that soundtrack. Listen to that soundtrack. It's a good one. And
I'll sell you my tape.
It's worn in all the right places.
Yes.
It's just jam it in your Spotify. Is that how
it sounds gross when you say it.
And you know, it's not on Spotify, the soundtrack. I guess maybe they don't have soundtracks on there. So what I listened to was a playlist that someone had made just using all the tracks from individual albums, which also meant the Let My Love Open the Door, the Pete Townsend song, was not the right version. It was like the version from the album. The version in this movie is like an alternate
God
version.
God damn it.
Shit.
Is this still recording?
Sadly.
Is anyone listening? Okay. Good night.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.